Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And this morning, we're going to apply what we know regarding the mind of Christ to veterans. The veterans of the United States of America who have fought in its many wars. And we will engage this morning two sessions called Veteran Chronicles. Throughout the history of our country, there have been numerous occasions when her citizens have taken up arms. The War for Independence was a successful effort to separate from Great Britain. The War of 1812 prevented a take-back. The Mexican-American War certified the victory of Sam Houston over Santa Anna at San Jacinto and established the Texas border at the Rio Grande. The war between the states saw fellow citizens draw the sword against one another. World War I was touted by President Woodrow Wilson as the war to end all wars, but it only served to percolate until the second act began with World War II. Following these engagements, there have been police actions, conflicts, and operations, but no officially declared wars. Some include Korea, Vietnam, Desert Shield, which was Kuwait, Desert Storm, Iraq, Deliberate Force, Bosnia, Allied Force, Kosovo, Enduring Freedom, Afghanistan, and Iraqi Freedom, Iraq, just to name a few. American soldiers, airmen, sailors, and Marines were engaged in most of these engagements, which found them fighting the enemy within the borders of the United States or on foreign battlefields. Our understanding of what these veterans encountered during their deployments is predominantly dependent upon reports done by war correspondents and historians. But the real eyewitnesses to the scrum of battle were those who wore the uniform of the nation's armed forces. Soldiers who made the slog through desert, marsh, mountain, and river. Airmen whose assignments to eliminate selected targets were met by anti-aircraft fire, dogfights, and missiles. Sailors faced battles at sea, kamikaze attacks, depth charges, bombs, and torpedoes. Marines engaged in amphibious operations that placed their troops in harm's way in all areas mentioned above. Many veterans have provided a written history of these wars by providing their eyewitness accounts of battle and campaigns in which they were engaged. In letters home, they have provided a chronicle of personal experiences in the battles in which they fought. Today, we will salute our veterans by noting a selection taken from a few of our nation's wars. The primary source is from Andrew Carroll's War Letters, Extraordinary Correspondence from America's Wars. And we begin with World War I. Ship's cook, Third Class Hugh Alexander Leslie, aboard the troop transport vessel, the USS President Lincoln, writes home giving details on the torpedo attack on the ship by German U-boats on 31 May of 1918. Of the 715 people on board, 26 men were lost with the ship. The first vanguard of American troops were rushed to France in late June of 1917, though it would be months before they saw combat. The threat of being killed, however, confronted servicemen even before they made it to the front lines. The large lumbering troop ships on which they sailed traversed thousands of miles of mined and submarine-infested ocean before reaching Europe. In the 3 years before the war, German U-boats attacked 28 U.S. ships, killing over 200 Americans. The voyage was especially perilous for the ship's crews who traveled between the States and France time and time again. Hugh Alexander Leslie, a cook aboard the USS President Lincoln, described to his family back in Kennedy, Texas, the sense of panic and desperation aboard the ship, especially of those who couldn't swim after being torpedoed less than 500 miles from France. The gun cotton Leslie refers to was used to make explosive powder. He writes, "My dearest and beloved parents, brothers, and sisters, I received your most kind and appreciated letters since I hit the old USA. Again, I suppose you read about us losing our good ship Lincoln by two torpedoes from an enemy sub. Also, the lives of 24 of our shipmates and three of our officers. Our paymaster and a lieutenant were taken prisoner by the Germans. I sent you a telegram as soon as I arrove in New York." I'm reading as they wrote it. "I suppose you received it in a few hours after it was sent. There is no need of me writing you all about the details of the brave crew of the Lincoln. Captain Foote complimented us again and again on our coolness, bravery, and obedience to orders, officers, and men of crew. We was 48 miles off the coast of Brest, France at 9 o'clock a.m. while we were stirring the brine to the tune of about 12 knots an hour. She sank in 37 minutes after the two torpedoes hit forward and aft parts of the ship. The explosions of the gun cotton were so violent, it stunned a number of the crew and tore enormous large holes in her hull on the port side. I and the other ship's cooks were on watch in the galley when the first one hit forward, and just as I stepped out the gallery, the second one hit right under the aft galley where we had just had dinner all set. It knocked me flat on the deck, and a shower of salt water and wreckage of hatch came falling all around me. It tore the galley upside down and wounded some of the fellows in there. The ship began listing to the port very rapidly. We all fell in our B deck as usual, as no more than an abandoned ship drill, as we had had them ever since we were on the ship. The general alarm bell was ringing and the siren was blowing keen blasts as a signal of danger. Also, the coarse whistle used in a fog was also blowing as for help. She looked like a large animal or a cow or a horse that was shot on the left side and groaning for help as they go down sideways. The same with our ship. Looked as if she knew she was sinking. There wasn't a man left the ship until the order was given to abandon ship by the captain. Our paymaster and associate paymaster were so excited they lost their heads. The paymaster, and always in charge of the consommary branch, the chief consommary stewards, cooks and bakers, and me, the cooks and bakers of the 9th Division were busy throwing off life rafts until the waves were almost washing over the deck. All the paymaster would do was to run up and down the deck rubbing his hands. I told him to jump off and grab a line to a lifeboat or a raft if he couldn't swim. I told him she was sinking rapidly, and he said, "No, Leslie, jump and save yourself." He took off his gun and dropped it on the deck, and a Negro grabbed it and blew his own head off with it as the ship was sinking. The last I saw him and others, it was going high. The waters were going high over the ship. I jumped and swam to a raft. It had taken some good swimming to swim to one of those rafts in a choppy sea as that. Some of the rafts were lashed to the ship and with the ship. Some of our best friends lost their lives when she went down. I was within 15 foot of it when she disappeared. We were in the water 15 hours before the destroyer picked us up that night. We went back to Brest and come aboard the Great Northern to steam back to the States. She is a fast ship, a 23 knotter an hour. We made this trip in 7 days, and you can take it from me, I was glad to be back here. The government gave us a full bag of clothes as we lost everything we had. I hit the water with a pair of white pants, an undershirt, an apron, and a white hat. We are a crew without a ship or a dog without a home. We are on the Antigone, one of the ships that was with us when we got hit. We are just staying here waiting for orders to go to the Navy Yard or barracks. I will knock off at present, as ever, H.A. footnote. Although initially in good health after his rescue, the 15 hours Hugh Alexander Leslie spent in the ocean weakened his lungs, and he died of pneumonia months after returning to the States. He was 21 years old. General John J. Pershing. Oh, by the way, I have a picture of him. Was born September 13, 1860 in Laclede, Missouri. He was graduated from Kirksville, Missouri Normal School with a BA degree in 1880 and from West Point in 1886 as senior cadet captain, the highest honor at West Point. In our next letter, he writes to his son Warren on October the 10th of 1918. On the morning of August 27th, 1915, a year and a half before America went to war, a newspaper reporter named Norman Walker called the office of General John Pershing in Fort Bliss, Texas. He called to confirm a tragic story coming over the wires about Pershing's wife and children. Certain the voice at the other end was a military aide, Walker inquired about the deaths at General Pershing's residence in San Francisco. "What has happened?" demanded the voice. It was Pershing himself. Norman stumbled through the report as the general listened. Mrs. Pershing, only 35, and their three daughters, ages 8, 7, and 3, were all killed when a fire swept through their house at the Presidio. The Presidio is an installation at the northern tip of the San Francisco Peninsula that was a military installation at the time and where General Pershing and his family lived. Only 6-year-old Warren was pulled out alive. Less than a year later, Pershing was sent to Mexico in the punitive expedition against Pancho Villa. And in June 1917, he was off to Europe to lead American forces in the war. Notoriously stern and reserved before the fire, Pershing became even more withdrawn in its aftermath. Pershing demonstrated great warmth and tenderness, however, in his letters to Warren, who was living with his Aunt May in Lincoln, Nebraska. The general wrote the following to his son in October of 1918. I might point out that in the few days that he spent dealing with his family's deaths, when he returned to Fort Bliss, he was completely white-headed. You see a little bit of that in this photograph. Here's the letter to Warren, who is at the time about 9 years old. "My dear Kitty, I have your letter of Sunday, no date written on letter paper with the stars and stripes on the edge. It makes very pretty writing paper. The letter was number 8, so I suppose you can tell the date, but I cannot. I have often promised in my various letters that you should come to France while I'm still here, and I'm going to keep this promise, and you may count on it. I do not know just when it will be, nor how I shall arrange it, but we can work that out a little later. I want you to come so that you can yourself see something of the army and see something of France. I want you to know, while you're still a boy, something of the fine patriotism that inspires the American soldiers who are fighting over here for the cause of liberty. They are fighting, as you know, against Germany and her allies to prevent the rulers of Germany from seizing territory that does not belong to them and from extending their rule over the people of other governments who do not wish to be ruled by Germany. I might add that in order to do this, the German army, under orders from the ruler of Germany, has committed most serious crimes, and for that also we are fighting in order to punish them. I want you to see some of the battlefields of France with me, over which the American soldiers have fought in carrying out the great purpose of our people. It will enable you to realize later in life just what sacrifice means and just what degree of sacrifice our army is called upon to make and which they have made and are making bravely and courageously. I think that you should talk this over with Auntie, and I want you to regard it, of course, as confidential, and let me have any suggestion you and she wish to make regarding it. In the meantime, work as hard as you ought to work, giving yourself plenty of time to play and exercise in the open air, to the end that you may prepare yourself as well as the average boy prepares himself, or better, for whatever calling you may follow in life. And might I add, as I have already said to you, that it is my hope that you will always be what I believe you to be, a very manly, honest, upright, industrious, wholesome, wide-awake boy. I look forward to your companionship with a great deal of pleasure, and after the war is over, we can have many good times together. Give my love to your aunties, and believe me, as always, yours affectionately, Papa. Footnote. General Pershing kept his promise to Warren, and in March 1919, the general and his son were reunited in France. Outfitted in a miniature officer's uniform, Warren toured the country with his celebrated father. Next up is Theodore Roosevelt. Former president during America's engagement in World War I, he did not serve but had four sons who served admirably. Brigadier General Theodore Ted Roosevelt, Jr., Captain Kermit Roosevelt, Captain Archibald Bullock Roosevelt, and Lieutenant Quentin Roosevelt. 59 years old, almost blind in one eye, overweight, and suffering from a host of illnesses, former President Theodore Roosevelt was denied his request to lead a division of men into battle during World War I. There is speculation that Roosevelt's ridicule of President Woodrow Wilson as yellow and a mollycoddle pacifist before the war did not help his appeal. He was, however, able to send overseas what amounted to a small army of Roosevelts. His four sons, and I'll show them in order of their birth. This is Brigadier General Theodore Roosevelt, Jr. He was in the invasion at Normandy and conducted events at Omaha Beach and received the Congressional Medal of Honor. Next up is Captain Kermit Roosevelt. He spent time actually in the British Army. He happened to be in the in-country at the time, and before the United States got involved, he volunteered to help the British. So she achieved captain's rank with the Brits. And then later, as the United States got involved, he moved to the United States Army. Captain Archibald B. Roosevelt, he was injured. You'll see him with a cane here. He had quite a number of injuries during battles in World War I and received several Purple Hearts. And this is Lieutenant Quentin Roosevelt, the youngest, and we'll learn more about him later. He was able to send overseas what amounted to a small army of Roosevelts. His four sons, Quentin, Archie, Kermit, and Theodore, or Ted. Ted's wife, Eleanor, who went to work in France with the YMCA. And his son-in-law, Dr. Richard Derby. 20-year-old Quentin, the youngest and most jovial of the four boys, was especially eager to serve. And despite poor eyesight, became a fighter pilot. He memorized the military eye chart in order to pass his physical. Fearless, almost to the point of being cocky, Quentin was thoroughly exhilarated by aerial combat. Quote, "You get so excited that you forget everything except getting the other fellow." On July the 11th, he described his first kill. "I was out on high patrol with the rest of my squadron when we got broken up due to a mistaken formation. I dropped into a turn of a vrill," that's a spinning dive. "These planes have so little, planes have so many surface," "These planes have so little surface that at 5,000 feet you can't do much with them. When I got straightened out, I couldn't spot my crowd anywhere, so as I had only been up an hour, I decided to fool around a little before going home as I was just over the lines. I turned and circled for 5 minutes or so, and then suddenly, the way planes do come in focus in the air, I saw three planes in formation. At first, I thought they were Boche." That's a derogatory name for Germans in World War II. Is that right? That's right. And Boche. "But they, but they paid no attention to me. I finally decided to chase them, thinking they were part of my crowd. So I started after them full speed. I thought at the time it was a little strange, with the wind blowing the way it was, that they should be going almost straight into Germany. But I had plenty of gas, so I kept on. They had been going absolutely straight, and I was nearly in formation when the leader did a turn, and I saw to my horror that they had white tails with black crosses on them. Still, I was so near by them that I thought I might pull up a little and take a crack at them. I had altitude on them, and what was more, they hadn't seen me, so I pulled up, put my sights on the end man, and let go. I saw my tracers going all around him, but for some reason he never even turned until all of a sudden his tail came up and he went down in a vrill. I wanted to follow him, but the other two had started around after me, so I had to cut and run. I could half watch him looking back, and he was still spinning when he hit the clouds 3,000 meters below. 3 days later, Quentin was shot down behind enemy lines. After word of Quentin's death was reported by the media, thousands of condolence letters poured into the Roosevelt's home in Oyster Bay, New York, and the former president responded to each one with at least a brief note of appreciation. But there was something about a letter from a Mrs. Harvey L. Freeland that particularly struck Roosevelt, and he sent the following handwritten reply. Sagamore Hill, dated August 14th of 1918. Dear Mrs. Freeland, last evening, as we were sitting together in the north room, Mrs. Roosevelt handed me your two letters, saying that they were such dear letters and that I must see them. As yet, it is hard for her to answer even the letters she cares for most, but yours have so singular a quality that I do not mind writing you of the intimate things which one cannot speak of to strangers. Quentin was her baby, the last child left in the home nest. On the night before he sailed, a year ago, she did as she always had done and went upstairs to tuck him in bed, the huge, laughing, gentle-hearted boy. He was always thoughtful and considerate of those with whom he came in contact. A week ago, a letter from him, written 2 days before he was killed, came to a devoted member of our family, Mary Sweeney, the chambermaid, who loved Quentin as if she had been his nurse, a gay and merry letter. It's hard to open the letters coming from those you love who are dead, but Quentin's last letters, written during his 3 weeks at the front, when of his squadron, on the average, a man was killed every day, are written with real joy in the great adventure. He was engaged to a very beautiful girl of very fine and high character. It is heartbreaking for her, as well as for his mother. But they both said that they would rather have him never come back than never have gone. He had his crowded hour. He died at the crest of life in the glory of the dawn. My other three boys are just as daring, and if the war lasts, they will all be killed unless they are so crippled as to be sent home. Archie apparently has been crippled by his two shell wounds, but has been struggling again against being sent home. Ted has been gassed and is now with his gallant little wife in Paris with two bullet wounds. He will be back at the front in a few weeks. Kermit won the British Military Cross in Mesopotamia, but is now under Pershing. My son-in-law, Dick Derby, a major in the medical corps, has been knocked down by a shell, but after a week in hospital is back at the front. A good record, isn't it? All four left their wives and their children, born and unborn. And in view of your liking the chapter of my autobiography for which I care most, I venture to say that the five boys who, as fighters, have won distinction against the greatest modern military nations I wish I could tell you some of their feats, are so gentle and are just as clean and good as girls. And I am just as proud of my daughters and daughters-in-law as of the boys. And we have such darling little grandchildren, they are of such comforts. Yes, the two anniversaries I have always remembered are our engagement day and our wedding day. But I have succeeded in hopelessly befogging myself as to whether my wife's birthday is on the 8th or the 6th of August. It's really the latter, but every year I have to be enlightened on the subject by slightly impatient offspring. Is your husband in the army? Give him my warm regards, and your mother and father and sister. I wish to see any or all of you out here at my house if you ever come to New York. Will you promise to let me know? Faithfully yours, Theodore Roosevelt. Footnote. Incredibly, the Roosevelt family retrieved the mangled axle from Quentin's plane and displayed it prominently in their home at Oyster Bay. In 1941, when World War II was declared, Archie, Kermit, and Ted Jr. all served again. Only Archie, who was hit by shrapnel and severely wounded in 1944 in the South Pacific, would come home alive. Ted died of a heart attack over a month after leading troops on D-Day. And Kermit, who had fought depression and alcoholism his entire life, committed suicide on June the 4th of 1943 while on active duty in Alaska. In addition, at the beginning of the United States' involvement in the First World War, Roosevelt selected his close friend Seth Bullock, the famous sheriff of Deadwood, South Dakota, as one of 18 officers to raise a volunteer infantry division, Roosevelt's World War I volunteers, for service in France in 1917. Congress gave Roosevelt the authority to raise up to four divisions similar to the Rough Riders. However, as commander-in-chief, President Woodrow Wilson refused to make use of the volunteers and the unit was disbanded. World War II. Douglas Fairbanks, Jr., the son of movie icon Douglas Fairbanks, became a very popular actor, but he also was among several Hollywood names who distinguished themselves in combat before or during their screen careers. Here are a few. Charles Durning was among the first American troops to land on Omaha Beach at Normandy, and later fought with Patton's Third Army during the Battle of the Bulge. He was awarded three Purple Hearts and a Silver Star. You know him as Pappy O'Daniel in O Brother, Where Art Thou? Audie Murphy is the most decorated soldier in World War II. His awards include the Medal of Honor, the Distinguished Service Cross, the Silver Star with Oak Leaf Cluster, the Legion of Merit, Bronze Star with Oak Leaf Cluster and V for Valor, Purple Heart with two Oak Leaf Clusters, the French Legion of Honor, the French Croix de Guerre with Palm, the French Croix de Guerre with Silver Star, the Belgian Croix de Guerre with Palm, and Combat Infantry Badge, among many others. James Stewart, retired in 1968 as a Major General, having served in World War II and Vietnam. His awards include the Distinguished Service Medal, two Distinguished Flying Crosses, four Air Medals, and the French Croix de Guerre with Palm. Douglas Fairbanks, Jr. was awarded the Navy's Legion of Merit with the Bronze V for Valor, the Silver Star, the Italian War Cross for military valor, the French Legion of Honor and Croix de Guerre with Palm, and the British Distinguished Service Cross. Thousands of American servicemen were injured or killed as a result of the Japanese kamikaze attacks, and one of them was a 45-year-old father of three from Philadelphia named John Kramer. An extremely popular commander, Kramer was befriended by the movie star Douglas Fairbanks Jr., who served in the United States Navy, saw combat, rose to the rank of lieutenant commander, and earned, among other medals, the Croix de Guerre, the British Distinguished Service Cross, and Silver Star. On December the 30th of 1944, a kamikaze plane deflected off the water and crashed into the USS Orestes, killing Commander Kramer and approximately 24 other men. When Fairbanks learned of his friend's death, he immediately sent Mrs. Kramer the following handwritten letter, dated January the 9th. This would be a 45. "Dear Mrs. Kramer, word has just reached me about John. No words of mine will supply the comfort and the strength which these days require. However, I could not let the day pass without letting you know how deeply I am feeling the effects of this crushing news. To say I was fond of John would merely be the echo of any and all who ever knew him. He was a man whose courage I admired, whose wisdom I respected, and whose friendship I treasured. No one will miss him as much as you, but I know that I, for one, will remember him with affection and count myself fortunate for having known him, for as long as I linger upon this mortal coil. Dick Marthelemus wrote me the news and said in part, I hope he is sitting on a nice, comfortable cloud conversing in Greek with a quartet of harps playing soft chamber music to him. He'd like that, and I feel sure that's right. This sort of letter should be brief, but I've gone on because I did want to say my say about a fine man, a courageous warrior, and a great friend. My wife joins me, dear Mrs. Kramer, in sending you and the children our most very sincere sympathy and friendship, and the hope that the great sorrow you have will somehow be mitigated by the pride you must also feel. Yours, Douglas Fairbanks, Jr., Lieutenant Commander, United States Navy Reserve." The next excerpt we're going to note regards two letters by First Lieutenant Fritz Snedeker, and secondly by Staff Sergeant Horace Evers. This has to do with the Holocaust and the German theater. This will take a little longer than we have left in our service for a session, so we will delay at this point to go to halftime. But before we do, I would like to make an announcement that this is Veterans Day weekend, as far as I'm concerned. And we annually add bricks to our Walk of Honor out front for any names that have come to our attention since the initial installation last year. We have five new names that have been installed. I invite you to go outside and see them, as the men who are presently in our company are able to do so as well. First of all, in the Air Force segment, is Charles Natch. Charles Natch is with the Lord, but I only learned on receiving the obituary after Charles's death just a few months ago, reading there that he served with great distinction during World War II in the United States, actually Army Air Corps, and later the United States Air Force. Not with us today, living presently, I think, in Arizona, is Les Gatto, who had distinguished service in the United States Marine Corps, and you'll find his brick there. The next three have served or presently serving in the United States Army: Stacy Robinson, United States Army; Ryan Johnson, who's United States Army National Guard; and Otis Leslie Johnson, the United States Army. I want all three of those guys to stand and get a round of applause. Will you guys stand up for me? I've always noticed that military guys are a little bashful about things like that. But after what I've read this morning and there's still more to come, we owe a lot to anybody who makes the choice to go into harm's way. We salute them today. There are others we'll note in the second session. But our military is the best in the world. We're honored to have so many in our congregation. We're a small church, but when you go outside and you look at the Walk of Honor, you'll see there are a lot of names on those pavers. Men that have been, and there's a couple of women out there. Men and women. I remember the Hunt brothers and daughter. Mother served as an aide to the United States Marine Corps during World War II. We ran out of men. And the Marine Corps needed people who were driving desks to put on the battle uniform and get into harm's way. Someone had to do the duty that those individuals were performing. And so it was suggested that as the Navy had waves and the Army had wax, that maybe the Marine Corps could also do something likewise. I forget the name of the guy who was the commandant of the Marine Corps at the time, and he said, it's not going to be an auxiliary organization for the Marine Corps. If we're going to do this, they will be Marines, they will go through boot camp, and then they will put on the uniform of the United States Marine Corps. And so that's exactly what happened. So Doris Tucker at the time, unmarried to Mr. Hunt, decided that she would join up and did and served honorably for well over a year as a United States Marine. So her brick is out there, too. I want to give her a salute. So when you go out there, there are these names who have been members of this church at one time or another, some deceased, and they have served honorably in our defense, providing us the privilege of gathering here to freely exercise our advance in the plan of God. We'll be back here at 10. I actually got it down to 10:30. How about that? Be back here at 10 till the hour. Please go out front during those 20 minutes and take a look at the Walk of Honor. You're dismissed.